This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. What little suspense remained is now over. Yesterday's Illinois primary put Senator John Kerry well over the magic number of 2,162 delegates, and last night the Democratic Party's presumptive presidential nominee finally declared victory. Interestingly, he did so not in Illinois, a state most every analyst places safely in the Democratic column, but in West Virginia, which is projected to be a battleground. As we look ahead now to the general election campaign, many political professionals believe the fight for about two-thirds of the states and the great majority of the voters is already over. President Bush and Senator Kerry are expected to fight bitterly in 15 states or fewer for a relatively small fraction of as yet undecided or persuadable voters. And increasingly sophisticated tools will help decide what issues they emphasize and where. Later in the program, an update on the massive explosion in downtown Baghdad today. At least 24 people are reported dead. And on the eve of the anniversary of the war in Iraq, we'll talk with a reporter who analyzed how an Iraqi exile group fed what turned out to be false stories to media outlets around the world, including in the United States. But first, we turn to political news of the week. There was more than just a presidential primary in Illinois yesterday. A senatorial primary raises the possibility of the fifth black senator in American history. Democratic presidential candidate Al Sharpton endorsed John Kerry but didn't quite step out of the race. And the war of words between Senator Kerry and President Bush continues to unfold. We'll take your calls and questions about the most recent changes in the political landscape. If you'd like to join the conversation, our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And joining us now in the studio here in 3A to review and make sense of this week's political news is NPR political editor Ron Elving. As always, thanks for being with us, Ron.
My pleasure, Neil.
So the day's biggest election story was also the most predictable. Kerry wrapped up the nomination. So what can we now expect from the Kerry campaign?
Well, there'll be even less attention paid to which state is holding its primary on each of the successive Tuesdays, although we do have a number of states that have not yet voted. They have not even necessarily been spending time in each one of those states up to now, since it's been clear for some weeks that Senator Kerry was going to have the nomination, really since the 2nd of March. On the other hand, it is an opportunity once a week to observe that there's a vote going on somewhere and people are being elected to other offices, and it's a chance for the Kerry campaign to get a little bit of attention. But now they've gone over the magic 2,162 delegate number in terms of bound delegates. Now, in some respects, they've already been there for some while because of the superdelegates who can cast their lot with whichever candidate they like.
Now, the war of words and pro-Bush, anti-Kerry ads started even before the senator officially clinched the nomination. Is this an indication of what we're going to see over the next 8 months?
Oh, it is indeed. We're going to have, I think it's safe to say, the longest general election campaign between the two major parties we've ever had. It's literally underway now, full force. We may get some surcease at one moment or another during the next 8 months, but not much. Traditionally, we didn't really start this kind of full-dress boxing until, say, Labor Day, after the two conventions were over and the two candidates would then go toe-to-toe. Already, we have the President of the United States making specific reference to the senator from Massachusetts, and there's no question who he's talking about. Plus, we have a host of surrogates for the president, including right now, as we speak, Vice President Cheney out in California giving a very hard-hitting anti-Kerry speech, very specifically about John Kerry. And we also have the head of the Republican campaign, the Bush-Cheney campaign, that's Mark Roscoe, the former governor of Montana, being very specific in his attacks on John Kerry on a daily basis. And so I think we're about as into it as we could be in mid-October.
Well, let's get into those a little bit. I mean, normally it's the traditional role of the vice president or the vice presidential candidate to be the attack dog, if you will. Up until today, at least, that's not what Dick Cheney's been doing.
Well, Dick Cheney has not been a traditional vice president in many ways. He has been a policymaker. He has been not only close to the president, but he has really been a confidant and a person who advises the president in a way perhaps no other vice president has ever been. Al Gore was close to Bill Clinton. You could say Fritz Mondale was close to Jimmy Carter. But I don't think we've ever seen a vice president who was as clearly a part of making up the president's thinking as this particular vice president has been for some while. So for him to now, in a sense, take a step down from his policymaking heights within the administration and become more of an in-the-trench brawler is going to be something of a change for him. Not to say that he hasn't had a political side all along, but he's going to be showing it, I think, much more aggressively, as you suggest.
Well, let's talk about also some of the surrogates who've been out duking it out. On the Republican side, as you suggested, Mark Roscoe has been out almost every day with a statement of some sort or another. Today, it was about a comment that Howard Dean, the former governor of Vermont, the recently defeated candidate for president, who just endorsed John Kerry, a couple of weeks ago, Howard Dean had to say about the elections in Spain.
Well, Howard Dean said this. He said the president was the one who dragged our troops to Iraq, of course referring to President Bush, which apparently has been a factor, this is Howard Dean talking, in the death of 200 Spaniards over the weekend. Now, this is the kind of talk that we got used to hearing from Howard Dean when he still was a presidential candidate, and perhaps it's something of an illustration of why, in the end, he won Vermont, his home state, and no other state, and why I suspect he will not ultimately be on the ticket with John Kerry. He speaks his mind. He does so somewhat intemperately at times, and he has a tendency to, in this particular connection, leave the impression that he's just blamed President Bush for that bombing in Madrid last week. Very few Americans would share that view. Some would, but that is not the kind of language that people would expect to hear at the top of the ticket or in the number two slot on the ticket.
And it gives the Republican an opening to drape Howard Dean around the shoulders of John Kerry.
Right, immediately, because Kerry has been campaigning a fair amount with Dean and trying to tap into what Howard Dean brought to the party in terms of energy and in terms of the kind of younger people and enthusiastic new recruits to the Democratic ranks. He's been trying to get that benefit, and now he's, of course, getting a little bit of the backlash as well as he finds out how the heat of Howard Dean can come back to burn you.
There are also some Democrats on the attack, or Democratic surrogates, and this is two groups, the Media Fund and MoveOn.org, and these are groups that have been raising a lot of money, soft money. They're not directly connected to the campaign, or at least they say they're not. The campaign says they're not. They shouldn't be, according to the law, but they're certainly taking out anti-Bush ads.
Well, by the law, they are not allowed to coordinate the ads that they take out, the issues they talk about, the themes that they strike with the campaign itself or with the Democratic National Committee. Now, as a practical matter, if they go out hammer and tong after President Bush, suggesting that he has been less than truthful, that he has been bad for the economy, that he has gotten us into terrible situations around the world, it doesn't take much coordinating for that to be seen as helpful to the Democratic candidate and harmful to President Bush. So here's a case where the law trying to keep these independent groups from coordinating with the actual candidates shows its futility.
Now, there are, I guess, at least 1.5 candidates in the race with John Kerry for the Democratic presidential nomination, and that would be Dennis Kucinich, who hasn't said anything, though Mr. Kerry is over the top, and Al Sharpton, who issued one of the strangest endorsements of a candidate I've ever heard.
Well, Al Sharpton is an enormously creative public figure and politician, and he has now created yet another new thing, and that is the presidential candidacy that continues even after you've endorsed one of your rivals. Not seen it before, but he has a purpose. He wants to be on John Kerry's good side. He wants to be seen as someone who can count and smell the coffee. And at the same time, he would like to remain on the stump, as it were, as a, quote, presidential candidate, unquote, even though he's endorsed someone else for that office. And in the end, he very much would like to address the National Convention in Boston this summer and do so as a person who still has delegates pledged to him, and he has some.
Another story out of Illinois' primary yesterday is the Democrat Barack Obama sweeping into the Democratic senatorial nomination. Why is this making national headlines today?
Well, you know, people used to say you had to have a common name to be in politics. Illinois now has a governor named Blagojevich, and they have now nominated the Democrats a senatorial candidate whose name is Obama. Not a good
Irish name.
Yeah, well, with an apostrophe, Obama, it is not. This is a man who has been a Harvard Law School star, was the first African-American to be the editor of the Harvard Law Review, has gone a long way to opening a lot of people's eyes to the capabilities of not only of himself, but of people like himself. In Illinois politics, he's followed a very traditional and yet unique for an African-American kind of trajectory, and now has brought himself to the brink of being elected to the United States Senate, where some people had said after the defeat of Carroll Moseley Braun in Illinois a few years ago, there might not be another African-American senator for some while. He got 53% of the primary vote in a large field there in Illinois, got over almost 650,000 votes in the primary. The entire Republican turnout was less, not much less, but a little bit less than the Obama vote alone. So he's in strong position going into the fall.
And the Republican winner was a millionaire named Ryan. His name, though, might not be such an advantage.
Well, here again, names matter. Jack Ryan is his name, just like the hero of all those Tom Clancy novels. And he's quite an extraordinary figure, too. He's only 44. He's made a huge fortune for himself on Wall Street and walked away, and now he's teaching at an inner-city school in Chicago. He did well in the primary, but he only got 35% overall, so he's got a little bit more uniting to do in the party. And, of course, the unfortunate thing about his last name in Illinois right now is it's the same one as the disgraced and fallen governor who's under indictment for corruption.
George, no relation, Ryan.
Unfortunately, the same name, even though they are not related.
Ron, thanks very much for being with us.
Always a pleasure, Neil.
NPR political editor Ron Elving with us here in Studio 3A. Now, for the rest of our time discussing politics this afternoon, we're going to be talking about swing voters and battleground states. And now joining us is Joshua Green, a senior editor for the Atlantic Monthly. He wrote an article in last month's issue entitled In Search of the Elusive Swing Voter, and he's with us here in Studio 3A. Nice to have you with us.
Good to be with you.
There are undecided voters in every election, especially when, of course, it's 8 months away. What makes the population of swing voters in this election so important?
Well, I think what makes it so important is if you take a look back at the last election and saw just how narrowly it was decided and just how evenly split the country continues to be in terms of the electorate, it's the swing voters, this very narrow segment of people who have not yet made up their minds who they're going to vote for, that could and probably will swing the election to one candidate or the other.
And swing voters not everywhere, not swing voters in Alabama or swing voters, for that matter, in Maryland, but swing voters in some very specific areas.
Certainly not, no. One of the interesting things about this election is that two-thirds of the country has basically been conceded by the two political parties. The Democrats don't expect to do well in the South and therefore won't devote a lot of resources to trying to win presidential votes in the South. And by the same token, Republicans won't spend a great deal of time in many Northeast states because they don't hold out a whole lot of hope of winning any of those. So what the election has really boiled down to, if you talk to strategists in either party, is a handful, maybe 12 to 15 swing states. And it's the swing voters within those states that both parties are going to be concentrating on.
And both sides seem to be using as their template what happened 4 years ago in Bush v. Gore.
It really is. If you talk to political demographers, one of the interesting things about the 2000 election is that what it really provided was a snapshot of a nation in perfect balance. And that's been the starting point for both parties to try and figure out how they're going to cobble together the 271 electoral votes that any candidate will need to win the election.
And one of the things you wrote about in your article is it's been an article of faith in the Democratic Party for many years that, well, you've got to fight for the South. There has to be a Southern strategy. You need to win some of those states. And some people looked at the election of 2000 and said, you know, hey, if we just won New Hampshire, we'd be in the White House.
True. It's been a subject of debate, and it continues to be. I mean, John Kerry made what turned out to be a bit of a political gaffe by suggesting that he didn't have to win any of the southern states this time around and pointed to the example of Gore in the fact that had Gore carried New Hampshire, he would have won the presidency without carrying a single southern state. And because of those facts, Democrats aren't going to focus a lot of time and resources. The Kerry campaign isn't. On southern states.
With the possible exception of Florida.
With the possible exception of Florida, of course. it's difficult to sort of say so publicly because there are still important House and Senate races that Democrats want to win throughout the South. So while this is a sort of truism, it's not one that you're likely to hear discussed very much.
We're talking about politics, the importance of swing voters, and particularly battleground states. Do you live in one of those places? If so, how does the battle look as you see it now, 8 months out from the election? We'll take your calls at 800-989-8255. Email us, totn@npr.org. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Later in the program, we'll bring you an update from Baghdad on the terrible explosion there this evening, Baghdad time. We're told at least 24 people were killed in what appears to have been a car bomb attack near a hotel in downtown part of the city. Right now, we're talking about election year politics and those all-important swing votes. Are you still making up your mind whether you want George W. Bush or Senator John Kerry in the White House? So what do you need to know to make the decision? Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Our guest here in Studio 3A is Joshua Green, senior editor for the Atlantic Monthly. And let's get a caller on the line. Gorman is with us from Newtown, Pennsylvania, widely agreed to be a battleground state. Gorman, you're on the air.
How are you today?
Very well, thanks.
I'm going to be quick. I got a couple of questions. I'd like to take the answers off the air, but first I want to say I voted for Gore, but I was disappointed because after the election he showed absolutely no leadership in his boss, and I was frankly kind of disappointed in my vote. Now I'm asking, I'd like to have these questions answered. Is Kerry going to say that we're at war or not, number one? And number two, what's his platform? I mean, electability is not good enough for me. I'm an artist. I've voted across the board in a number of elections, and electability isn't going to fly with me. So I'm kind of confused about his message because of all the negative and all the confusion. So if you can clarify that, I'll take that answer off the air. Thanks very much.
Okay, Gorman, you may not want to take our word as gospel. You might want to listen to something that Mr. Kerry says. But, Josh, what do you think?
Well, he raises an interesting point. The issue of electability was enough to get John Kerry nominated because what the partisan Democratic voters in the primaries were looking for was a candidate, any candidate, that could beat Bush. But by definition, swing voters are voters who don't have it in for Bush. And so it's going to take more than that to convince them, as the caller made clear. I do think that Kerry will acknowledge that we're at war. I think much of his message will be about what he will claim is Bush's failure to properly prosecute that war. And as far as Kerry defining his platform and what he's going to stand for, I think you're going to see that rolled out over the course of the next 6-7 months.
Given the nature of the battleground states, and you describe them, there's including Pennsylvania, there's some in the central Midwest, Pennsylvania, West Virginia, Ohio. There's a group of states running down the Mississippi Valley from Minnesota on down. There's a couple out in the Pacific Northwest and in various parts of the country. But you suggest there's going to be different issues targeted to each of those areas.
Well, there really are. I mean, these are broken up into different geographic areas, as you mentioned, and a couple of them are Washington and Oregon out in the Pacific Northwest, where, you know, candidates can tailor their message to appeal to those particular audiences. I mean, one example is Ralph Nader in 2000 drew a very high degree of support from the Pacific Northwest, where presumably environmentalism was a very important issue.
Mm-hmm.
So what I suggest in this article is that it would be wise for the Democratic nominee, in this case John Kerry, to spend some time up there and talk about these issues, particularly because Nader has announced that once again he's going to enter the race.
Email question from Steve Austin in Portland, Oregon. He says, I'm in Oregon, a swing state, given the severity of the local recession and the fact that President Bush lost, albeit barely, in 2000. How do Republicans think they can possibly win my state?
Well, I think judging from the message that Bush has rolled out so far, it's not going to be a focus on the economy per se, so much as Bush's leadership in the war on terrorism and the war on Iraq. I mean, if you look at a lot of what's going on in terms of his surrogates going out and talking, it's sort of touting Bush as a steady hand and steady leadership in a time of trouble. And I think that's the campaign that's going to continue for the next 6 to 8 months.
And sometimes, of course, it's not whether you actually win in the state, it's whether you force your adversary to devote a lot of resources in that state that they might have otherwise spent more profitably elsewhere.
Exactly. And as long as Bush can stay competitive in Oregon, which at this point it certainly looks like he can, it's not a state that John Kerry can ignore and will therefore have to spend time, effort, and money trying to win over voters like the one who just emailed in.
Let's talk now with Peter, and Peter joins us from Columbus, Ohio.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Sometimes we're led to believe that there's 6 undecided voters in Ohio and they're going to decide the next presidential election, Peter.
Well, I've talked to all 6, and the 6 of them believe that economic issues are going to predominate in their thinking, which leads me to think that Ohio is tending towards Kerry. I'm hard-pressed to imagine what the Bush strategy is going to be in terms of selling his economic performance if economic issues are predominant in the voters' minds.
And I guess that's the question, Josh. Are economic issues going to be uppermost in voters' mind? And, of course, we're 8 months out. The economy could be in a different condition then than it is now.
It could still, yeah. And if you listen to the Bush campaign, you know, a lot of what they're talking about is they're trying to sort of sell the notion that the economy really has turned the corner. We've sort of hit the low spot and we're on the way up. Suggesting that while manufacturing job losses, and Ohio has been particularly hard hit, having lost, I think, 151,000 manufacturing jobs during Bush's presidency, with the economy turning around, hopefully with job creation, we haven't seen a lot of evidence of that. But it's going to be a tough sell to people in the Rust Belt and in Ohio particularly.
So we had several people on the program last week discussing some of these same kinds of things. But basically they said if the election's about the economy and how poorly it's doing, President Bush is in trouble. If it's about the war on terrorism and leadership, he might do rather better.
I think both sides would agree with that. And I think the fact that Bush is focusing on the war on terrorism is sort of an implicit acknowledgement of that.
Peter, thanks very much for the call.
You're very welcome.
We're going to now talk with a couple of political professionals. And joining us now from his office in Virginia is Bill McInturff, a Republican pollster, partner, and co-founder of Public Opinion Strategies. Nice of you to join us today.
Thank you, Neil. Thanks for being on the show again.
And we're often told that, you know, these are statistics. About a third of the country is registered Democrat, about a third Republican, and about a third independent. Of those independents, how many are actually available? How many have already made up their mind, do you think?
Well, I think the independents even less than that. If you look at hard independents, people who refuse to lean either party, you're talking about 14 to 18% of the electorate. And of those, only about a third have not yet made up their mind. What makes this election different so far than what we've seen in the last 30 years is today, 8 years before the election, I'm sorry, eight months before
it's only going to seem like 8 years.
It feels like 8 years. Thank you. People are unusually polarized, and we have a very, very narrow band of people who have not yet expressed a preference. And the Republicans have very strong favorable views about the president, and Democrats rate this president, and the gap fairly low, and the gap between how Republicans and Democrats rate President Bush is now the largest in this country's history since we've kept track since 1948 of partisans feel about the president. It's a very, very polarized electorate.
Now, all right, given those truly undecided are not a very big slice of the population, who are they? What do they look like? What's the profile?
One, Latinos. Two, there are people who describe themselves as being hardcore independents, somewhat moderate on issues. They also tend to be younger, people under 35 years old, and they tend to be only vaguely attached to the political process in terms of kind of day-to-day interest, and usually about 60% are women. And although their votes will vary, these are people who are not going to make up their mind until really literally the last weekend. And so we're going to have a very unusual election where huge chunks of America are as polarized and as divided as we've seen in modern polling history. And this very narrow band are up for grabs and then decide, I think, very late in the election.
Now, do you think that this race this time around, obviously still 8 months away, is going to be as close, or it's hard to imagine it could be closer than 2000?
I would keep in mind that we have the potential for the race to break open, although break open means somebody wins 53-47, 53-46. But in terms of the Electoral College, it could get to, you know, somebody could get to 350 votes in the Electoral College. It's very, very hard to believe or plan for a race as exactly close as 2000 or 1960 or 1880, whatever. You know, those are incredibly rare in history. Normally, the way the Electoral College was designed, it normally works. Even somebody who wins a fairly narrow plurality or majority of the popular vote wins something like 300 or 320 electoral votes. And I would think that just by historic standards, that's a lot more likely occurrence.
Let's get another caller on the line. And Carl's with us from Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Hello.
Hello, Carl. You're on the air.
Basically, my first reaction on turning the radio on just a few minutes ago was to think, I don't want to think about this right now. I've already heard an awful lot through the primaries and through that whole season about what's going on, who's going to win, what's going to happen after that. We've got 8 months to go, and I think there's other things we need to be talking about. I'm getting sick of it already, and I'm sure I'm going to hear a lot more about it between now and November.
Well, Bill McInturff, I think he's right about that last thought, but how do you address voters like Carl who are sick of it already and likely to get more sick of it?
Well, here's the good news. He lives in Oklahoma. Although he's listening to a national radio talk show, this is going to be an unusual race. If you live in one of these 17 states, you're literally going to watch $500 million of advertising. And if you live in a state like Oklahoma, you're not going to see much of it. What I think is going to happen is I believe that the Bush folks believe that we're at an unusual point where after this primary where people are very engaged, and they're trying to engage the electorate with what they think about John Kerry before that kind of tune-off process starts. I will also say, by the way, we have really cool data that's, again, very different than we've seen before, where we've asked people, how interested are you in this election in November? And today, in March, more people are saying they're very interested than they were 10 days before the election of 2000 or 10 days before the election in 1996. So in some ways, in this highly charged, polarized atmosphere, the hard partisans, strong Republicans, strong Democrats, are really attuned to this race and have very strong feelings. But I can tell you that the average swing voter is going to get, you know, very bombarded in a handful of states. And one of the reasons they'll decide so late is they literally will push it off and say, man, I just don't want to think about this. And they're trying to do all they can to ignore it until they have to make a decision in the last few days of the campaign.
Carl, good luck.
Thank you.
Appreciate the phone call. And Bill McInturf, wanted to thank you for your time today.
All right, sir. Thank you, Neil.
And I assume we'll be back in touch with you before it's all over.
Okay, thank
you. Bill McInturf, a partner and co-founder of Public Opinion Strategies. He's conducted polls for everyone from John McCain to for National Public Radio as well. And he joined us from his office in Virginia. And, of course, polls keep the public informed of how their friends and neighbors are voting. They also, and maybe more importantly, keep candidates and their advisors in the know about their standing in the public eye. Dan Payne, who joins us now, is worked as a media consultant for Michael Dukakis' presidential run in 1988, among others. He's currently a campaign analyst for our member station WBUR, and he joins us now from his home in Newton, Massachusetts. And, Dan, welcome to the show.
Good to be with you.
Shoveled your sidewalk there this morning?
Yeah, and I'm going to have to shovel again, I'm afraid.
Oh, boy. It's just sad when the snowplows lead the St. Patrick's Day Parade, isn't it?
That's right.
Which is more important to a candidate, swing voters or swing states, or are they? Is it possible to differentiate between the two?
Well, you can be a swing voter in a state that's either red or blue, that is to say, either Republican or Democrat. But what matters in terms of the conversation we've been having is the swing states. That's where the concentration of money and candidate time is applied. If you happen to be a swing voter and you live, say, in California, which is thought to be pretty much in the Democratic camp, you may not see much of a campaign. Whereas if you live in Tennessee, perhaps Missouri, the campaign may bombard you.
And so those are going to be where the campaign is fought out. Do Republicans and Democrats really have much disagreement on what these battleground states are going to be?
No, not really. As you said earlier, it's pretty much follows the lines of the last presidential election. There's a sort of a truism in American politics is that you start with your base and then you spend the middle of your campaign trying to convince the other guy, the other guys and the undecideds, and then you close with your base. So Democrats have been working on their base through the primaries for many months now, and so once we stop following these faux primaries, the candidates, both candidates, Kerry and Bush, are going to be applying attention to the swing votes. But ultimately, they will, in the fall, have to go back to their hardcore supporters.
We're talking politics. Right now, our guests are Dan Payne, a Democratic media consultant, and Joshua Green, a senior editor of the Atlantic Monthly. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get a caller on the line. Brian joins us. He's a trucker now on I-10 in Arizona.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. I've actually just crossed the border into New Mexico now.
Okay. From one swing state into another, but go ahead.
I'm originally from Springfield, Missouri, and that's where I reside, and that's where I will vote from. Although I'm pretty well decided that I'm going to vote for Kerry, I'm talking to my friends regularly about the failings of the Bush presidency, and I think it's very important that swing states, you know, see this, you know, that the electorate gets educated.
Well,
it's from friends or
is there anything that the President Bush or the Republicans could do to win your vote at this point?
is there anything he would need to get rid of his attorney general?
Well, it's probably you never know what's going to happen, but certainly the tenor of the administration is unlikely to change in that respect.
Right. It's just far too conservative in the sense of the religious right. It really concerns me how much influence the religious right has in the Bush presidency.
Well, Dan Payne, that raises an interesting point. That's sort of lumped into what you guys tend to talk about as values, and played a big part last time around. Is it going to be as important this time around?
Well, it already is. Bush has made gay marriage a major part of his campaign, pushing for a constitutional amendment. There will be lots of other of these so-called values issues that will be projected into the campaign. What the caller says is kind of interesting in that I think the opportunity in some of the swing states is to make the race a referendum on George Bush and his administration. Bush wants it to be, at this stage anyway, a referendum on John Kerry, a senator, and whether you know him and can trust him. Bush is much better known. People have made up their minds about him. But he's been looking at some very bad performance lately on the economy and some very bad news coming out of Iraq. And I think voters are ultimately going to decide this based on whether they think Bush has earned another 4 years.
Brian, thanks very much.
Okay, well, thank you for your time, and thank you for taking my call. Aaron Gobra, Brian Kelly right here.
Okay, drive carefully, Brian.
God bless you.
Before we go, I wanted to bring Josh Green back into the conversation. One of the things you wrote about is there are now very specific tools that both campaigns have available to them to look at this very small number, these very specific groups. We just have a few seconds, but tell us a little bit about
that. Well, there really is. I mean, the computer and database technology has progressed to the point where both the Republican National Committee and the Democratic National Committee have vast voter files of 160 million voters with all sorts of lifestyle variables appended to them and so on and so forth, and have very high-tech ways now of reaching voters that they know to be swing voters and reaching them with particular people and particular messages which they believe will cause them to vote for their candidate.
And in very specific ways as well. It's going to be a fascinating race. We'll, I'm sure, be talking with both of you again. Joshua Green, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks.
Josh Green is senior editor of the Atlantic Monthly. Dan Payne, thank you for your time today.
You're welcome, Neil.
Dan Payne, Democratic media consultant and presidential campaign analyst. For more coverage on the 2004 presidential election, you can visit the Talk of the Nation page at npr.org. After a short break, a report on the explosion today at a Baghdad hotel. At least 24 people are reported dead. Plus, we'll hear how Iraqi defectors use the media to disseminate questionable information before the invasion of Iraq. I'm Neil Conan, and it's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.